This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, and I want to talk to you about the choices you've made that have brought you to my office today, my podcast today. That's because my guest is University of Pennsylvania historian Sophia Rosenfeld, the author of The Age of Choice, A History of Freedom in Modern Life. Her book explores why we basically come to equate having more personal choices with having more freedom. I know I do. She stresses that it wasn't always this way. In the past, freedom was often defined as the ability to act in the way that God wanted you to act, or to overcome your more base urges, to be more angel than beast. Rosenfeld talks about how the Reformation, which enshrined a right to choose among faiths, and the rise of shopping, which allowed us to choose among many options right in front of us, worked to change all that, even up to our current day, where rhetoric about choice still dominates many political and economic arguments. This is a mind-blowing conversation, and I hope you choose wisely to listen all the way through. Here is The Reason Interview with Sophia Rosenfeld. Give me a quick précis of the book's argument.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. I think choice is one of those things we do tend to equate, as you've just suggested, sort of automatically with freedom. It's sort of the water we swim in, that more choice is better, more opportunities for choice is better than less. And I'm not here to really dispute that exactly, but I'm interested in both the good and bad things it's brought us. And I'm also interested in how that happened, because actually what's so perhaps surprising to people is that freedom hasn't always been conceptualized as a matter of choice, and choice hasn't always been conceptualized as what brings us freedom. So the story that I tell in the book is really about two things. It's about how choice came to proliferate so that we pick things in really disparate areas of life, ranging from political candidates to breakfast cereals to who we want to marry. We pick in all sorts of categories that would have seemed strange to people, still does to people in some parts of the globe today, and certainly would have to almost everyone around the globe in an earlier moment a few hundred years ago. So I'm interested in how that happened. And then I'm interested in how that came to be understood as freedom. Why freedom became a matter of choice, because there's nothing actually obvious about it, though to us it sometimes seems that way. So the book traces a whole series of social practices that people engaged in, things they did, essentially. How did people start picking things in stores? How did they come to think of ideas or even religious notions as something one could select from a menu of options? And it goes all the way up. It starts really in the Reformation and in the first age of empire, but it takes us all the way to the 20th century and the invention of whole sciences of choice to study why we're choice makers.
So let's run through all of these. And also the other thing that the book focuses on in a way that is fascinating is the way that choice often became identified as a feminine, a part of being female, and also oftentimes kind of depreciating choice because it's something that women would be dazzled or overwhelmed by too many choices in front of them in consumer goods. And, you know, there's a long history, certainly in European or continental and Anglo kind of studies of, shopkeepers are sad little men, right, who are somehow not quite manly in the way that, the martial virtues are. And choice gets identified with femininity in various ways. We'll get to that. First, let's talk about before the modern era, before the Reformation, choice, freedom was not about choice or to the extent that it was about being able to make the right moral choice. I mean, it wasn't, partly when I was reading this book, I think it was back in the 80s, but at some point 7-Eleven stores, they brought in soda fountains that had both Coke and Pepsi products. And they had a huge campaign saying, freedom of choice. Like we celebrate choice, choice, choice. Like that's freedom, being able to have Mountain Dew and Coca-Cola without going to two separate stores. But in this period, when we're talking about Hercules' choice or the pre-modern definition of freedom, what was Hercules' choice and what does that say about earlier conceptions of freedom?
Right. So if you were a person living in the 17th or 18th century, in Western Europe, say, or even in the burgeoning United States, you probably would have been familiar with this idea of Hercules' choice. It's allegorized everywhere from poetry to opera. John Adams proposed it as the seal for the new United States. And it was kind of harmonized with Christian teachings. So they went well together. And the idea was this. Hercules was torn. He was torn between doing the right thing, virtue, and he was, or the opposite, turning towards vice. And often in a painting, you see his body kind of torqued. He can't quite decide which way, but he always, in the end, goes towards virtue, which is doing not what just he is hedonistic, not recognizing his hedonistic pleasures, but doing what was right morally, what was right for his family, what was right for his community. And in the end, Hercules always makes the right choice. Mm-hmm. And so choice, and he became free by himself of his own volition, doing what was right.
Right. And he's, and in that sense, he's not a, he becomes free because he triumphs over his bodily urges or more base impulses.
He triumphs over his passions, his base impulses, and he goes towards the moral, but as his own person. He isn't compelled to be moral,
right,
but realizes it's important for him to do the right thing.
So and you're free when, to the extent that you do what God kind of expects of you, or, you know, or morality, which, you know, which is identified at that point, ironically, since it's Hercules and he's, you know, a pre-Christian myth figure. But, you know, if you're doing what, you know, a Christian God tells you to do, which is to be more of an angel and less of a beast, you've achieved freedom.
Absolutely. So this could be all these things harmonized, what God wanted you to do, what your family wanted you to do, what your community wanted you to do, lined up.
Yeah.
And the idea is, of course, Hercules is a man, is this is only allegorical, but he's picking between two women as virtue and vice. Mm-hmm. So it's really imagined as a kind of manly freedom, too.
Right.
It's a kind of vision of thinking of others before oneself. And not giving in to base temptation, but being free to be the upstanding person that you're supposed to be. And this is a really important early modern trope. And it never entirely goes away, of course, but it's not the dominant way we think of them today, of course.
No. Well, let's talk about that. And I mean, obviously, there's a lot of things that, you know, that drive the shift from that kind of freedom to a freedom which is identified with more choice or increasing choice in all areas of human kind of activity. But a big part of it, you mentioned it briefly in passing, is the Reformation, or the idea of religious freedom and being able to choose among different ways of worship. I mean, for the most part, it's different ways of worshiping the Christian God, or the Christian God is defined. But how does the Reformation help start to create a shift in how we understand freedom?
Right. So one way to tell this story would be to see just simply capitalism taking over everything, that everything just becomes a marketplace. And certainly that's an important part of the story, but I don't think it's the whole story. I think the other point of origin, the less obvious one, may be the Reformation for two reasons. First, the Reformation sort of inadvertently ends up creating pluralism in the religious sphere. Right. Protestants especially, there are so many sects by the end of the 16th, 17th century that, you know, in order for people to live together, they have to essentially accept, even though nobody really wanted to, the idea that Lutherans were going to need to live near Methodists, who were going to need to live near Calvinists, etc.
And it is worth talking about how, like, and of course, none of them were saying, oh, and we should put up with Catholics.
No, absolutely not.
And Catholics were not, you know, particularly interested in putting up with
Far from it.
Right.
This is a kind of inadvertent effect of the Reformation. Right. Everybody thought they had the right answer. Mm-hmm. But over time, I'm talking to you from Philadelphia, my current city. And, you know, if you were in Philadelphia, a place of religious toleration in the 18th century, on a Sunday morning, you could have heard sermons by, you know, something like 12 or 15 different kinds of Christians. And that doesn't even include Jews or potentially Native Americans and other kinds of religious.
I mean, I think in the colonial period, probably the only place, and I think it was more in, you know, kind of rhetoric than in reality, but Providence, Rhode Island, you know, coming out of Roger Williams' area, he stubbornly agreed, you know, that Jews, Catholics, Mohammedans could, you know, could live there in equal standing, but certainly not in most of the colonies.
And one thing you see that's really surprising is that tourists, for instance, who come to Philadelphia in the 18th century, will try out different churches on a Sunday morning. They'll write something like, heard the African Methodists at 10, very interesting sermon, enjoyed the Baptists even more at 11. You know, that's an odd, but it's an entertainment of sorts, and it's an intellectual entertainment. And those become secular lectures and things also over
and
time.
And then that does mirror the kind of burgeoning rise of what we now call capitalism, of you know, where there is more of a marketplace in most goods and services, right? So that suddenly, you know, there's a religious marketplace which may or may not anticipate, but I guess it develops kind of at the same time as a new economic system is coming over that really kind of increases or proliferates choice. So talk
That's
a little
great.
Bit about how capitalism does that. And if you could, because he's got a ridiculous name, but it's also fascinating, you know, this is a history book, but a great character, Christopher Koch.
Yeah, he's an
character.
He
kind of exemplifies this. Right?
Yeah. So I will just say this, just to finish on the religious topic, because I don't want to suggest that people sort of picked religions the same way they picked toothpaste or something. I mean, obviously there's some differences.
I think we do that now.
Maybe we do, but you know, these are kind of parallel stories that eventually merge rather than all being the same thing. And of course, freedom of conscience, this other great Protestant idea, is very important also to the idea of selecting what one believes. But to get to the other side of this story, that's the kind of religious strain. At the same time, something else is happening first in Europe, and it spreads to the New World as well, as Latin America, as well as North America. And that's the rise of stores, shopping, and different from a marketplace. A marketplace, people have always bought things, but you know, you went to a market mainly to provision yourself. Got what you needed, somebody handed it to you, there was a transaction. But with the rise of auction houses first, which is where Mr. Koch comes into play, and with fixed location stores shortly after, came these new practices of displaying the goods and of letting people do what we'd call browsing now. And the word shopping itself is a neologism. It's a new word in the 18th century. It starts to show up in, you know, kind of a fashionable term by the late 18th century. And it means something very specific that we do all the time. You do it even when you're browsing on your computer, which is kind of just looking at the options, deciding which ones match your preferences, and then engaging in a kind of transactional sale. So Mr. Koch is this figure who starts an auction house in the early 18th century in London, and he's kind of a wizard of marketing, I think you might call him. It's not that auctions are brand new, they have auctions in antiquity, but he decides he could turn auctions into a kind of theater, an entertainment. And women and men are both invited to come on special hours to look at the household contents of people, and then to sort of be tempted and come back and make selections. And he sets up what I would call a kind of visual menu. And this happens again in stores a little later when cottons start arriving from India, patterned cottons, and they're these beautiful fabrics, and they're available at a low enough price point that ordinary people, not the kind of people who'd be buying fine silks, can walk in and say, you know, I do like blue better than red, or checks are more appealing to me than stripes. And there's no moral implications around that choice. Yeah. One of the things that starts to happen is these are largely value neutral choices. One, you know, it's not Hercules' choice, the good or the bad. It's two things. I like one of them better than the other for reasons I can't really explain, and I'm going to take the one I like. And that's...
Does this also start to degrade? I mean, you know, in terms of the moral choice, it also, I mean, you know, and this is part of a lot of different processes, but it starts undermining a kind of rigid class structure, or it starts to challenge sumptuary laws to some degree where, well, you know, only it used to be only certain people could afford certain fabrics, or and then there might have been laws saying only certain types of people could wear certain types of clothing, et cetera. And suddenly when things become more available to more people, it gets kind of confusing, right?
Absolutely. At first, there's a kind of confusion. People start saying, what if servants start dressing like masters and we can't tell if somebody's in a floral dress who they are? But, you know, and it has a lot to do with urbanization too, where people don't know each other necessarily. Yeah. So that arises as well. But I think an interesting thing happens, what you're suggesting is true, that there's a kind of deregulation that goes with this that allows, say, anybody to meet the purchase price to buy something. But then new forms of regulation start to emerge. I just want to emphasize, taste.
Abstract
ideas both, or new kinds of laws.
Both social, kind of social customs, and then also laws and things like that. Because the book, I think, is excellent in kind of driving home the point that even when it seems as if we have unlimited choice, we always are experiencing bounded choices by things like taste is interesting and other kinds of social pressures and sometimes legal ones. Could you talk a bit about how did kind of consumer choice get so heavily identified with women so that there's a whole subgenre in English writing as well as colonial American writing, and it persists in novels and whatnot, of, you know, women being particularly interested in choosing among novel goods and then somehow being seen as suspect. They're, you know, women more than men. It happens to men, but usually as they approach femininity, you know, get dazzled by too many choices. Why did consumer choice and the female sex get kind of conjoined?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, isn't it? How did choice, at least initially, get so associated with women? And I think it goes back to that term shopping. The first shoppers are imagined to be women, and they're women with leisure time. They're kind of middle class or higher status women who, if you've read a Jane Austen novel, you know, do things like go out for their entertainment in an afternoon and look at hats or ribbons in one of these new kinds of stores. And they're both extremely modern because they're doing this modern thing, but they're also quite chastised for it because it looks really kind of lightweight, morally unserious, especially in light of, say, Hercules' choices. Right. If you're thinking of that as kind of manly choices, these are choices about things like ribbons or people to dance with or boyfriends, as we'd call them. And for a long time, they taint this kind of choice. But an interesting thing happens in the 19th century. This kind of value-neutral choice starts to shift directions and becomes something associated also with men. And then for women, having more choices in this domain becomes aspirational. It's sort of at the roots of feminism.
Right.
For somebody like John Stuart Mill, even the idea of the secret ballot, surprisingly, Mill, the great champion of choice and freedom and liberal notions in the 19th century, is really afraid of voting that he thinks will look too much like shopping. You know, where you're isolated and you make a decision based on your personal preferences. He says the only manly kind of voting is much more like Hercules' choice. It's public. It's about the general good. It's done in concert with others. And it's only by the late 19th century, only in the late 19th century, really, that this kind of feminized version of choice becomes universal enough that it becomes the standard for things like suffrage and human rights. And then women want it too. And women say, well, you know, look, we're the old, we've always known how to choose things. Why can't we choose political candidates? Why can't we choose occupations? You know,
before we continue with the recent interview, I want to tell you about the Future of Freedom podcast. If you're tired of cable news debates and Twitter shouting matches, and you're looking for serious good faith conversations between people who actually care about liberty, then it's time to check out the Future of Freedom podcast. Each episode dives deep into a single topic, tariffs, campus speech, DOGE, and it brings together two guests who disagree on the best way forward. But here's the twist. This is not a debate show. There's no interrupting and there's no dunking. Each guest, whether libertarian or conservative, has to make their own case, not just tear down the other side. It's compelling, it's civil, it's genuinely challenging. You'll hear familiar reason voices like me, Stephanie Slade, and Joe Lancaster on it, alongside other principled thinkers on the right and center right, each bringing sharp ideas to the table. So if you believe the future of freedom depends on more than just winning arguments and you're ready for something deeper than the usual echo chambers, check out the Future of Freedom podcast. Real disagreement, real ideas, real conversations. Subscribe to Future of Freedom wherever you get your podcasts. That's Future of Freedom. And now, back to the Reason interview. To kind of start bringing it up into the 20th century, when you're talking about the 19th century, how does how does the idea of choice as freedom start to fill in for things like abolition as well as feminist equality before the law? What are there particular moments where people say, we should have, I myself as an African chattel slave, I should have the same choice to choose among things as, a white citizen or somebody in the marketplace, in the same way that when I go to the market to buy something, I'm choosing among competing goods. Are there moments like that where explicitly the idea of having more individual choices becomes linked to freedom in kind of the modern sense?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you mentioned abolitionism. I think that's mm-hmm. one of the starting points. It's developing in the 19th century, but it's not the strongest strain yet. But in the 20th century, I think two things happen that are really important here. One is the development I mentioned a little bit earlier of sciences of choice that get us to, mm-hmm. Things like psychology,
right. People
are choosers, economics. Again, turns towards consumption rather than production mm-hmm. as the kind of central thing. Homo mm-hmm. economicus is somebody who's buying right. Things.
And people like, for the Reason audience, at least the Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises mm-hmm. talked about praxeology and humans as the choosing animal. That right. is expressly what defines us as a species. So
absolutely. That's the kind of culmination. That's a perfect mm-hmm. example. First, there's these kind of the social sciences themselves reimagine mm-hmm. humans as choosers, and ordinary people participate in this every time they do everything from, respond to advertising or mm-hmm. surveys or go to a psychologist's or psychiatrist's yeah. office. So that's one thing that happens. And then I think around the time of the Second World War is a really critical moment when the Allied powers, and especially the United States, start to say that what makes the U.S. and its allies different from communists mm-hmm. or fascists is this notion of freedom as choice, mm-hmm. both in the commercial sphere and in the political sphere. And by the time you get the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is 1948, mm-hmm. I think it's striking. People often say it's just kind of the same as the rights of man of the 18th century rewritten in the 20th century, but it's mm-hmm. not, because choice isn't there in the original ones. And the mm-hmm. reframing in the 20th century yeah. as choice in religion, choice in education, choice mm-hmm. in spouse, choice in the political sphere, all of these become kind of essential human rights principles. And a lot of other movements, including feminism, yeah. kind of capitalize on that and say, what about right. us? What about us? But
yeah.
the basic framework is, I think, set by the Second World War. And the key thing here is the way the political and the economic are fused in that model.
Right. But there's also, this is well done in the book, the discussion of this creates a massive amount of anxiety across every possible level of society. And it's interesting to think about the Declaration of Human Rights, or rather, that foregrounding choice. But then all of the great sciences coming out of the 19th century seem to be, which are born out of a liberal society where people are free to experiment and do different things. But if it's Marx, Darwin, and Freud, they're all kind of saying that, it appears that we have choice, but we don't. We're designed by economics. We're designed by our psychology or our biology to we don't really have much choice at all. And that gets compounded when, I think a lot about the books like The Hidden Persuaders by Vance Packard in the 50s, where he's talking about how, advertisers are working with psychologists to kind of make people in marketplaces think they're choosing, but in fact, they're going to buy the red car. They're going to buy the new refrigerator. And you really, you have no say in it. Can you talk a little bit about how those you know, the anxiety that is introduced by the idea that people have more choice, but then also this shadow idea that no, we're choice is always kind of fake, and we're scamming people by telling them that they have choice.
Right. There are critiques all along, and they come from the right and the left. So it's not like there's a single politics that critiques this model. On one side are the people who say, what does it mean to give people a choice if they don't have the means to exercise them? So if you tell these people, you know, you have choice in profession, you have choice in education, and nobody has any means to say, get the education presented, what kind of choice is that? So that's one kind of illusion. And the other was the one you're suggesting, which might be equally as important, is aren't all these choices sort of like inconsequential and therefore give you the illusion of some kind of freedom when you have very little, either because you're steered to do what you do by various external factors or because the choice doesn't really matter that much. So you go to the supermarket and there are 50 kinds of shampoo and you spend 15 minutes trying to figure out which one you want. And they're all probably sort of the same.
And this, we're in a bizarre moment of kind of horseshoe theory where somebody like Bernie Sanders a couple of years ago talked about how, you know, we don't need 23 flavors of deodorant or 50 types of sneakers. And then you hear somebody like Tucker Carlson now saying the same thing, that, you know, being able to buy more cheap crap from China on Amazon is not going to, it's not a meaningful choice. So that's
interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's, you know, part of what we talk about when we think about choice, and the sections in the book on this are phenomenal to read, kind of the genealogy of how abortion rights became kind of codified as reproductive choice. And you can we talk a little bit about that? Because that brings us up closer to, you know, the present day. But you write that when abortion laws were being, or the rhetorical arguments over abortion, particularly as Roe versus Wade was starting to come online and right after, that within feminist organizations, there was a discussion of like, do we talk about this in terms of choice or not? And could you just kind of summarize that and explain how that fits into this larger set of issues that you're engaging?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been thinking about the debates about choice because as I was writing the book, of course, we've been having these national conversations about abortion rights after sort of 50 years after Roe v. Wade. And what really struck me was that in the 1970s, right after Roe v. Wade is decided, the mainstream feminist organizations like NOW and Planned Parenthood are basically looking for a way to kind of mainstream this decision, to make abortion less of a contentious issue. And they come up with what they think. You know, they think, should we try equality? No, that's got issues around it. Should we try population control? That now seems crazy to us, but that was one of the issues possible. Healthcare, that's what the British go with. They decide against that. And a number of the organizations come to the conclusion that the one thing all Americans across the political spectrum agree upon is the value of choice. And this, as you just said, choices really run across the left-right spectrum pretty fully. So it's not a crazy idea to say, what if we just say, look, you don't have to like abortion. You don't have to have an abortion if you don't. We're just increasing the menu. You know, we're giving you one more option as a legal possibility, and everybody can select what's in their own best interest. And I think we thought this was really a kind of solution to a problem.
Right.
Well, it didn't work out, obviously, quite that way.
Although it's kind of fascinating that in the wake of Roe being overturned and decisions being put back to the states, that a number of states that were expected to, of course, enforce particularly, you know, 19th century, you know, measures against abortion. I'm thinking of Kansas as an example and Ohio. They were like, hey, you know what? We're not going back. We're actually going to instantiate a liberal political, you know, what we're, you know, in contemporary terms, liberal abortion laws.
It is fascinating because the attack from the left is maybe easier to understand is the one saying, what's a choice if I don't have any, if there are no doctors and I don't have money to pay for this? Mm-hmm. That's sort of the classic version.
Yeah.
The attack from the right, though, went back to the kind of Hercules' choices model and said, the right to life is a consequential moral decision. You're just offering up again a kind of like a consumer options.
Right. And yeah, I was thinking of, I used to see the bumper sticker quite frequently. It's a child, not a choice.
Exactly.
Which is interesting, but it also kind of concedes the fact that the choice rhetoric won and was very useful. And it's been adopted to the extent that school choice is more of a right-wing kind of phenomenon. You know, it employs the same logic that giving parents and children more choices on a menu of options to, you know, and we will give you the money, the voucher, or, you know, the public funding to, you know, make meaningful choice because you'll be able to actually exercise your option.
Right. So it, I mean, in some ways, the women's organizations in the 70s were prescient. They figured choice is an easy sell for Americans. It's an easy sell in a lot of the world is to simply say, you know, people like reproductive choice on one side, school choice on the other. They're fighting about what should be chosen, but not about choice itself. And when you say that the reaction in Kansas and other places has been really interesting because people will argue against abortion, but they won't necessarily want to give up on the idea that the choice should be out there. So they might say, I don't actually believe abortion's a good, a good thing. On the other hand, do I really want to tell everybody that they can't have it under any circumstances? Right. A lot of people have said no, surprisingly. Yeah. So I think we are, you know, we're in a way, choice seems like a not very successful way to sell the public on an idea, but it does continue to have a kind of resonance that makes it an effective political tool. And you saw during the during COVID-19, for instance, the great feminist expression "My body, my choice" being appropriated by people who were protesting masking or vaccine mandates,
right?
Which was, I think, a very unexpected twist.
Yeah. Well, that is, you know, it seems that Americans, I guess, like choice rather than mandates, right? You know, and this, it kind of goes across political lines because I, you know, it's fascinating, this slightly off topic, but prior to COVID-19, Pew ran in the early 2010s, did a survey asking people across political lines, were they pro or anti-vaccine mandates or vaccines? And being anti-vaccine was more of a left-wing cause in the early 2010s. And now it has become very hard-coded right, even if Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is, you know, was a liberal Democrat and is now in the Trump administration.
Yeah.
It's kind of fascinating. But that idea of, I don't want to make that choice, but I want to have the possibility of opting out.
Right. I mean, I do think that's a kind of residual instinct that people have. Choice is good. Yeah. Where I sometimes worry, though, is that there's a difference between a choice you can make where, based on your own preferences, that only affects you. You know, I choose to do this. It makes no difference to your life.
Yeah. Right.
There are other kinds of choices. Vaccination, for instance. If rates of vaccination get too low, it affects everybody's kids.
Right.
Right. Because that's how we.
Well, and this is, you know, it's fascinating because there are arguments that because the COVID vaccine does not stop the spread of the disease, but it weakens it for the person who takes it. It's categorically different than, say, like a measles vaccine.
Right. But let's say measles for an example.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I was going to say that somebody like RFK has had to, you know, who was very anti measles vaccine. I mean, that's you know, that was his first big kind of foray into public discussion about vaccines. He's kind, you know, he says, you know, COVID-19 mandates are bad, vaccine mandates are bad, but he's had to admit that mandates actually serve a public function in a way. I think that he was kind of eating a little bit of crow there. You write towards the end of the book that choice, whether about babies or baubles or beliefs, should be a means, not an end unto itself. Can you explore or explain a little bit about how does that play into a larger question about, you know, what are the limits of talking about choice as freedom and complicating the easy equation of just saying more choice means we're more free.
Right. Well, your example of measles vaccines actually it would work there to that point, which is to say, I think if you want to think of sort of three shifts, there's the Hercules choice, the right thing or the wrong thing.
Right.
There's kind of value neutral choice emerging. which is to say what I like better. And then there's the one where the value itself becomes the choice. Just having a choice itself is what matters. And many times, of course, I'm not a critic per se of choice. I think choice is, you know, no one wants to be coerced on most fronts. But if choice is always the highest value, we sometimes lose track of what we're choosing and why. You know, and this would be a case in which, for instance, if you start saying my body, myself, and you're talking about measles vaccines because you just feel the most important thing is getting to do what you want to do.
Right.
A certain kind of selfishness emerges where you've lost track of why you're choosing what you're choosing. And there are other examples one could point to, too, where sometimes choice can be liberating, but choice isn't always liberating. Some kinds of choices are either, as you said, illusory, or they actually can kind of trap you in various ways and prevent us from thinking, what's in our common interest here? What would be the best case scenario? So I'm more interested in people have a kind of self-reflexiveness about choice than I am sort of telling people these are the good choices and these are the bad ones.
Well, that's and you say at the end that, you know, too much of our history, and you talk about behavioral economics and whatnot, is it seeks to explain a kind of path dependency. Okay, these choices were made at a particular time, and that's how we arrive at the current moment. And it kind of makes sense whether it's good or bad, but it would be good to be able to get outside of that and to think, I guess, in more, and I'm not accusing you of being a utopian in a dark sense, just of like, what if we're actually starting over when we're talking about some set of activities or about whatever society might look like.
I don't mind being called a bit of a utopian because, I mean, it's less, you know, I'm not sort of asking people to set policy this way as much as kind of rethink some of the things that we take to be absolutely natural and ordinary.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's, I mean, certainly, right? This is, I think, in a weird way over the past, I don't know, 30 years, or I'm thinking of my professional life, the idea of demystifying nature is, for God's sake, like we need to be doing that all the time, right? And we have been as a society. So that's very good. Do you, you know, what I, this may be, you may be the wrong person to ask for this, but, you know, when you think about the choices that all of us are making, you know, on a given day, just because we have more things that we're doing in a given day, you know, and I, you know, I have children who have grown up in a world where they just are making more choices. You know, if they're turning on a TV or a phone, you know, you go from 3 channels to 30 channels to an infinite number of, effective channels on the internet and beyond. You know, what are the ways that we might become better? And you were talking about being self-reflexive about choice. But, you know, what, give us a tip as we end this conversation.
So it's true. We're all a little overwhelmed with choice at the moment. And there was an interesting literature, some of it by people in things like behavioral economics and marketing, saying, you know, nobody really wants to go on Amazon and, you know, you need a new toaster. You really don't want to see 500 toasters. You really would probably prefer to have three different ones at 3 different prices and you just pick.
And by the way, that literature, I know in the social psychology or behavioral psychology is highly contested, but one thing that is true is that Amazon is now putting out, like, you know, they're sharing influencer picks with you so that, you know, maybe you follow an influencer and they say, here are 5 great toasters instead of wading through an infinite number.
Wire cutter or something, right? Yeah. I mean, we look now to both algorithms and all kinds of consultants to help us with every kind of choice, if we can afford to, which is to say everything from a personal shopper or a decorator to a financial planner to an algorithm that says you like this movie, you might like this other one of the 800 we're offering you. We can use those. Of course, they tend to reinforce. They don't allow you to really dip into new things. They sort of reinforce what you've already done. But I think more important is to think about when choice is really valuable to you and when it isn't. And not all choices matter. Some matter a lot. You know, think long and hard about, say, who you want to spend the rest of your life with. But back to those toasters or something, you know, doing hours of research on 500 toasters and trying to figure out the best deal by checking every possible site and things is a kind of source of, you know, frustration,
Obsessive anxiety. Compulsive, like, right. Is a 4.2 rating that much better than a 4.4 or whatever
that
means?
Or you spend half the evening looking through the options on Netflix before you can pick, you know, what your family's going to watch because you've been...
Well, that has just shifted the drama, the family drama of cruising Blockbuster for a movie everybody will watch. Right. Now we do it in the living room, right?
And we still put the things, you know, Amazon tries to sort of mimic the experience because you have baskets, for instance. You put things into them. Then you go to a checkout. You sort of mimic what those 18th century shoppers were doing when they first learned to make choices. And it was novel then. Now we just have sort of electronic versions.
Right.
But I do think we could think more about, both as a society, that's maybe my utopian part, but also on a personal level, when is choice meaningful? And when is it actually preferable to say, you know, eat the dinner that's being made. Don't think about, does everybody at the table want something different? And what would everybody prefer? And we don't add to our happiness. And I don't think we even really add to our freedom always in those actions. And it might make the choices that matter sort of easier to deal with if we didn't think we were making 50 a day.
Right. That's great. Okay, we're going to leave it there. I've been talking with Sophia Rosenfeld, who's a historian at University of Pennsylvania, and the book is The Age of Choice, A History of Freedom in Modern Life. Sophia, thanks so much for talking to Reason.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.